So welcome to Live Life Beyond Potential, Live Life Your Way. I am totally out of it today. I have such a headache. So welcome to Beyond Potential, Live Life Your Way. It's Tuesday evening. And I, as I always say, like without, you know, question, Tuesday is my favorite time of the week. I nearly said year just then, right? My favorite time of the week. Why? Because I get to play with you. I get to talk to interesting people who have interesting lives, who are actually living life their way. It's very rare that I have a person that has a job come on my show. Most of the people that come on my show are really passionate. If they do have a, they have careers or they have passions that they're really into and they're really passionate about. And it's things that they have wanted to do since they were children. Mm-hmm. Like, so, you know, one of the attorneys that came on the show, Pablo, he always knew he wanted to be an attorney since he was a little kid, right? So I have a lot of people who have written books. They've always written books, or they've always wanted to write stories, or they've wanted to give to charity, or they wanted to, whatever it is they wanted to do, they've known that something that they've wanted to do for many, many years. And a lot of people, you know, they do jobs for a little while, like hone their skills, because I think corporate is like a big fat university. This is where you hone your skills and you learn to steal supplies. Never did that. And then you go off into the world on your own and you make your life happen. So this is what my show is about. It's about people's passions. It's about showing other people that they can actually do anything that they want. We are here to live life our way, and that's my mantra. So
deep
I'm
breath.
Here deep breath. I am hot, and I'm not going to say that word because my sister will, she always says to me, what, nobody wants to hear about that, right?
But
sweating, yeah. So what was my weekend like? Oh, I went to the African Street Festival. It's another festival. Go ahead, sweetie. It's another festival that takes place in Brooklyn. Like, we have BAM, and we have the African Street Fair, right? And I usually call it the family reunion, because I get to see all my friends that I haven't seen in a year or a little bit more, and we get to connect. So I bumped into a lot of people this time. And this time around, I went with my lover. That's what I call him down, the lover, right? And it was a lot of fun. I had a lot of fun. And then, so that was my weekend. It was just based upon fun and enjoying myself and being decadent and, you know, hedonistic. So anyway, less of me and more about tonight's show. Tonight's show is with Melissa Unger.
If I don't
mess up your name, then you're not on the show. I mess up everybody's names. And Melissa and I met, how long ago?
About a year.
It's a year already?
I think so. Close to 9 months.
Wow, we could have had a baby.
I feel like it was last summer. Yeah, I feel like
I think it was last summer.
Yeah, I think it's about a year.
No, it wasn't last summer because you were wearing that puffy coat, the furry coat.
Oh, so maybe, but it's been at least 6 months, don't you think? No, that was the white coat. That was like a year ago, March. It was more than a year ago. More than a year ago.
So Melissa and I met in Connecticut Muffin, right? Connecticut Muffin to me is like, what was it that Seinfeld went to? He went to a coffee
that
shop
diner,
as well, right?
Yeah,
the diner, right? Shop,
yeah.
So Connecticut Muffin is like my Seinfeld diner.
Totally
you get to
is.
Meet. But only difference between going to Connecticut Muffin and the Seinfeld diner is that we talk to everybody. Well, I do. We talk to everybody. I don't just sit and talk to my George or my whoever and Kramer. I meet people. So Melissa and I met at Connecticut Muffin and we hit
in Brooklyn.
Right? In Brooklyn, yes. Yeah. Connecticut Muffin in Brooklyn, in Clinton Hill.
Mm-hmm.
And we hit it off immediately. I mean, it was like coming.
Destiny.
It was like coming home, right?
It was bizarre.
And you were coming home.
Yeah, I was coming home. But it was we had an instant connection.
Absolutely.
It was quite something.
So we've been talking on and off, well, at least once or twice a week, right, for the last X amount. We don't know. It's timeless. It's been forever. We've been talking. And we've just gotten closer and closer. So Melissa is extremely passionate and interesting and creative. And she just spent a decade and a half in France, right? So I would like to invite Melissa to the show and welcome her on. Thank you for coming.
It's my pleasure. I'm thrilled. Thank you for having me.
Just give the folks a little bit about who you are, what you do, and what brought you back to the United States.
Oh, my gosh. It's always really hard to synopsize quickly because mm-hmm. I've had a pretty eclectic career. Mm-hmm. If I had to give a top line of it, I've always worked in creative fields. Mm-hmm. And I've always worked in creative fields that have... in recent years, a social impact, I would uh-huh. say. So I started out production managing music videos in uh-huh. the 90s.
What kind of music videos?
Heavy metal bands. Oh, uh-huh. Yeah, it was like the heyday of music videos. It was like 89 to 92. It uh-huh. was a really, really fun time. I uh-huh. was in London and in Los Angeles, uh-huh. and it was bands like Alice Cooper and Faith No More and mm-hmm. all that kind of stuff. And uh-huh. I worked for...
Lots of makeup, lots of screaming.
And I was fortunate to work for a great director called Ralph Zeman, uh-huh. who was at the time one of the most creative music video directors. Uh-huh. So I got thrown in right in the deep end with people that were living their passions uh-huh. and thinking outside the box. And I think that that sort of set my track, you know, for right. the coming years.
I'm gonna say that it probably validated your track.
No, to be honest with you, when you were giving your intro and you said people always knew their passions, I wish I could be sexy and say that I always knew. Uh-huh. I don't know that I did. Uh-huh. I think that I knew that I was interested in people mm-hmm. and in creativity mm-hmm. and in freedom.
Mm-hmm. Sounds like me.
Yes, I knew that there probably wasn't going to be a straight line for me, mm-hmm. But I would not be telling the truth if I said that I had a plan.
Right.
I think that I just moved instinctively forward, sort of step by step,
right.
based on my interest, my learning curve. I tend to, once I know how to do something and once I've sort of metabolized the lessons right. of the job and the people that I'm around, I get right. hungry for something else, you know, and I move on to the next thing.
So what did you go to school for?
I was an English major at uh-huh. school. I went to Tufts University. I originally went there for their international relations program because mm-hmm. I wanted to be a photojournalist. Mm-hmm. And when I look back, I realize that it's always been kind of about image and words, mm-hmm. you know, and how those things come together. Mm-hmm. It's kind of how I make sense of the world. So whether I'm looking at art or photography or film, there's some sort of interpretation of the world
right.
mixed with language, right. which is writing, which I also do. And so I think I was just feeling my way forward with that. Uh-huh. And the international relations program, at the time in my life, I went to school when I was 17, and I had just come out of the Lycée Français that was mm-hmm. very, very strict and rigid mm-hmm. in its curriculum.
Say that again, Lycée.
Lycée Français de New York. And I think that I needed a little bit more flexibility. Uh-huh. So I dropped the international relations major.
Just kept the relations.
I did English. Yeah, English and photography, which was basically a lot of, you know, smoking cigarettes, reading poetry, taking pictures, and hanging out, if I'm really honest. Sorry, Mom and Dad. I don't know if the money went to good use, but that's what I was mostly up to at school.
Okay, great. So, but it's, I mean, even though you didn't, I didn't have a straight line as to, you know, I didn't go to French school or anything like that. I went to public school in England, yeah. but I would say that one of the things I wanted was freedom. It had to be fun and it mm-hmm. had to be creative because that's who I am, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, being that who you are is that you're able to create on a dime. You're able to see something and want to get involved and master it, right?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
And so I guess, you know, I guess that's why we connected, because once you've mastered something, it's like, next.
Yeah. I recently had my 30th college reunion mm-hmm. and I found...
How was that?
It was really fun. And I found... you know, the book that you fill out when you go freshman year,
right.
and it says sort of your interests. And I was 17 when I wrote it, and it said film and people. Uh-huh. And I thought it was really interesting that people was already there when right. I was 17, because I don't think I was thinking about the things that I ended up thinking about later right. in life. But there was a sort of pre-conscious mm-hmm. notion mm-hmm. that I was attracted to sort of the human aspect right. of the world, and I don't think that that's ever left me. And right. I think that the creativity was just because that was what I had a proclivity for. But I think more than the creativity, the underpinning of what interests me is humans and, yeah. and human minds and, you know, yeah. all that kind of stuff and how it ticks and imagination mm-hmm. and inspiration. So it's that really that
something just popped into my head. It's like, what do you think of people that say, oh, I don't like people?
Oh, I don't know. I wouldn't judge them. It's, I guess, to each his own. I like people.
Yeah, I know. For me, it's like, how can you not? It's not like a judgment because people do what they do, right? But it's like, how can you not like people?
Well, maybe people have had bad experiences with other people. And maybe I know, that's but we it's like getting bitten by a dog. You don't like dogs.
Yeah, I did get bitten by a dog when I was a little girl. I was 11 years old and I still got the scar on my leg. Where I got bitten by the dog. But I like dogs now. Yeah. I didn't like them. I was afraid of them before.
See,
but now
so maybe
I like
that's
them.
Why people don't like people, because they've had a bad experience.
So I snooped around on your website today, and there was one piece of work that you wrote, and it was called The Mean Mind.
Oh, I wrote that for Nutmeg Aspirin. Yeah, that's my my friend Mara's website. Yeah, it's very good.
I really like that, because I was thinking, oh my God, I think we all have a mean mind, right? But you named yours so well, and you were able to really kind of capture what your mean mind does. Like, you're doing laundry at this 10, 11 o'clock at night. What are you, a loser?
Yeah, I struggled with that for a very long time. I spend a lot of my life battling that mean mind. And
don't you think we all, though?
I think we do. And in my case, talking about where it came from, which was certain things perhaps in my family and childhood. And I've sort of metabolized all of that. And I don't talk about it so much in detail anymore, not because I don't want to share it. But I realized that in talking about it, while it helped me move past it at that time in my life, it kept me sort of beating the drum of something negative. So I couldn't let go of it, you know? And so now I sort of just name it and say, oh, this thing happened that created that mean mind in me, but we don't need to talk about it again, because then we're calling it up again. Let's talk about the solution instead.
Absolutely.
And I would say that...
So what would you say to somebody who is dealing with that? Like,
well, first of all, I would say, to answer your question about do we all have a mean mind, I think we do. And the mean mind is the one that is self-criticism, right? So it could be called the critical inner voice. It's the thing that shames us, that keeps us from trying things, or, you know. And I think that people experience a different level of handicap depending on how sort of loud that voice is, right? So everybody has it a little, and if you have it like on volume one or two, it doesn't really impair your functioning. If it's on like a six or a seven, or eight, which is probably where mine was, I was functional, but it was quite handicapping at a time to letting me do what I wanted to do. And then, not to get too heavy, but people that go into probably addiction, you know, or numbing behaviors, their mean mind is like 11, like Spinal Tap 11, you know. It's like it's off the charts, you know.
Do we need to take a break? Okay, let's just take the break. She's really kind. So we'll be back.
You're listening to the Talking Alternative Network.
You're listening to the Talking Alternative Network. Are you stuck in a rut? Negative thoughts, feelings, and conversations got you down? Hi, I'm Noreen Sumter, the Potentiator. Tune in every Tuesday at 9 to 10 p.m. Eastern Time and listen for new ideas on my show, Beyond Potential, Live Life Your Way, on talkradio.nyc.
Are you a conscious co-creator? Are you on a quest to raise your vibration and your consciousness? I'm Sam Liebowitz, your Conscious Consultant, and on my show, The Conscious Consultant Hour, Awakening Humanity, we will touch upon all these topics and more. Listen live at our new time on Thursdays at 12 noon Eastern Time. That's The Conscious Consultant Hour, Awakening Humanity, Thursdays, 12 noon on talkradio.nyc.
Talking Alternative Radio, 24 hours a day.
Back, I was just hiding there. It's like a puppet show. We're back on Beyond Potential, Live Life Your Way. And this is Noreen Sumter with Melissa Unger of the Seymour Project.
Yep.
Seymour, but spelt S-E-Y-M-O-U-R.
It's my father's first name.
Oh, cool. Seymour. Mm. Yep. Suddenly Seymour.
I can't join you in that because I'm tone deaf. I can't sing. Good at lots of things. Singing is not one of them.
So you are an English major, and on the break you were just mashing it up with your fellow English major, and suddenly found out English major is a club.
Yes, because we get teased a lot. It's considered the sort of useless major, right? It's like...
But why would it be considered the useless major?
People do. They always say, oh, you were an English major. Like, what are you going to do with that? You know? And so what I was saying to... I don't know your name.
Kelly.
To Kelly... was where we were like fist bumping about English majors, was that it's actually served me very well because it's helped me be more articulate. It's helped me express my ideas in writing and verbally, which I think is really important, you know. And we were also talking about how it helps you stay connected to sort of the history of humanity because you have a proclivity for reading, and you know, so I actually think it's really useful and actually very multifaceted. And
Sounds really useful to me.
It's quite a good major. Yeah,
I mean, because at the end of the day, everybody needs somebody who can articulate language.
Yeah,
and can create words that make sense.
Mm-hmm.
So you being an
and build bridges, I think.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
but, I think it's needed in every aspect of humanity.
Yeah, it gets a bum rap, right, Kelly, sometimes? Yeah. It, yeah. So we're here to say English majors
are good.
I'm
an English major, and I'm like, so it's like, okay, what is she? Is it like an
eye
roll?
Yeah, I think it's a holdover from a time when you would go to college to get really practical skills.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that in previous generations, you know, it would just literally like you would go to learn like a trade or something that would set you up, you know, in a more traditional path. And so English majors just had this sort of vague feeling about it that wasn't necessarily going to translate into dollars earned. Right. Do you know what I mean? And so that's why it gets a shit rap. But
This is free for all. Live
I can say
your
anything
way.
I want.
Say anything you want.
But anyway, it certainly served me well, and I loved it, and I have no regrets. Although when I do think about college, I do wish I had done a little bit more work. Like, I do look back on it
you
now.
You were 17.
Yeah, I was really, like, screwing around. Like, if I had it to do over, I would have sort of maybe added a
history.
What
was your GPA?
Oh, my God, I am never sharing that on radio. I will tell one funny story, though. I had a group of five friends, and we were all kind of rebellious, and I thought that everybody was screwing around, but it turned out that they were screwing around with me one-on-one while the other ones were working. So, and I was the only fixed point that was always screwing around.
Right.
So I was the only one that didn't do any work while they were doing work. And because my name is Unger, when we graduated... and they called the diplomas up, I was the last one called, and they all graduated with honors.
Oh, wow.
So it was like, so-and-so, Phi Beta Kappa, so-and-so, summa cum laude, so-and-so, magna, and I was like the idiot, and I was like, what the hell? I thought we were all like, you know, effing off. Like, what happened? You know. And
so did you see them at the reunion?
I did, yeah.
And how are they doing?
They're doing great, and we're all very good friends, and we stayed friends the whole
time. I went to college at 16, 17 in England. I had no idea what I wanted to do. I just thought it was the thing to do. And I was supposed to be doing business or something like that, but I never went to school. I went swimming.
Wow. See, and it worked out for you,
I went swimming and partying, right? And they kicked me out, right? But the way they did it, I didn't even know that I was kicked out, right? Because, you know, you're 16, 17, you're like, yeah. Right, so he came and said, Noreen, you know, you're a wonderful girl, you're very smart, but you're very distracting. That's my whole life, right?
Oh,
you're very
so
distracting. Maybe you should consider getting a job. And I was like, you think? And he was like, yeah. And I said, what am I going to do? And he goes, I'm sure you can find a job. I did. I actually found a job in a week and a half, like a week.
Were you bummed at the time, or were you?
No, I was too freaking naive to know any better.
Right.
Like, he said, I think you should go get a job.
Interesting. So you didn't complete your education?
No, I didn't complete my education in there. And then when I came here, I went back to school at 27.
Oh, wow.
And I thoroughly enjoyed it.
Interesting.
Right? I was pretty shocked because I thought I was shit at school.
Right.
But when I went back for my grades, they weren't shit. They were pretty good, considering I didn't study.
Right. I wonder if, like, we send kids to school too early. Do you know what I mean? Like, you haven't decided maybe what you want, and when you go back later, you know, I mean, to answer you, like, I had like a B average or something. Well, I wasn't a terrible student. I think I was having a pushback because my high school was very, very strict.
Right.
Like, the French system is very strict.
Right.
And I think that I just needed some space. Yeah, I needed some space. And so, and it's funny when you were talking, it's like, I think that, you know, you would think about these things in, to be honest, like, right. I haven't thought about my college, you know, I'm 51 years old.
Right.
Like, I haven't really, college feels like a very long time ago. But when I think about what I was doing then, which was apart from the smoking, which I don't smoke right. anymore, but it's just like sort of
that was probably
out,
a French holdover.
Right, hanging out and talking about it. I mean, that's what I've made a career out of. Do you know what I mean? So in a way, it's sort of what is inherently who you are. Mm-hmm. It was like talking, being interested in what
High
you
five,
know,
girlfriend.
You know, you they try to beat it out of you, but at the end of the day,
yes,
you come right
do.
Back to who your natural
yes, they do.
Your natural propensity is.
They
you
try
know?
To beat it
they
out
do.
Of you because and, like I am. Yeah, I was that girl in class that was always talking and giggling.
Mm-hmm.
That's who
you
I am.
You still are.
That's who I am. And maybe like, Noreen Johnson, that was my maiden name.
Yeah.
Johnson, did you repeat to me what I just said. And I'd go, and then be like, right? Because right. And they said, maybe you can do it, but the other girls can't do it.
Right.
Well, I'm not the one that's always talking. They're talking to me
right.
or looking at me, and then I start laughing. That's the story of my life, you
right.
know? But yes, I was extremely talkative. If you looked at all my reports, it's like Noreen talks a lot. If she could focus, she'd be great. Instead of like being distracting or
right.
Noreen is very distracting. But I did. I went back to school at 27 when I came, you know, after being here a few years. And I thoroughly enjoyed it, right? And like my GPA until I went to Nomura Securities, which was a bank, was 4.0.
Wow.
Right? And I went to school sort of like part-time. Well, not part-time. I did full-time credits, but like, you know, like that. And finished school in 3 years.
It's interesting.
And it was just real. And I never thought that I would be that person.
Yeah. I mean, I think one of the problems for me was that I have a little bit of a different way of thinking.
Uh-huh.
And I don't know. I mean, I've never been, you know, diagnosed or anything
right.
like that. So who knows? And I don't really believe. I mean, I don't want to take out the whole
right.
field of psychiatry and say I don't believe in labels, but it's really hard, you know, it's always moving, you know, like
well,
on,
yes, it's not static.
Right. But for instance, like I do very poorly on standardized testing,
right.
like on things like SATs
I
and
do
stuff,
really well with those now.
See, it's interesting. And I did very poorly on anything that had multiple choice. And at one point
I did really well with that.
So
now.
We're different.
Yeah.
So what was interesting is when I looked into it at one point, like early in my life, one of the things that we came across with whoever the psychologist was that I was talking to said that I was a 360 degree thinker,
right.
which meant that I could go 180 around a problem, mm-hmm. which means yes and no.
And it's true.
And then I can go all the way around again
right.
and talk myself into, you know, why what I just proved is actually the opposite of what I just
right.
proved. So what that does is it's great for innovation
right.
and it's been great for my career, like
right.
as a consultant, because I get paid to open new avenues for people and, you know, see different things. But if I'm doing a multiple choice test,
right.
it's impossible for me to pare down the choices because
right.
I can convince myself that any one of those choices, you know, is the right answer.
Right.
So when I was at school, I remember I was in a psychology class and I actually talked the teacher into letting me take essay tests. And
right.
he thought it was harder. He was like, why would you want to write, you know, an essay? And it was actually easier for me.
Yes.
You know, so
that's what we had in we
right.
had to write essays.
So no, I think I mean, education and not to, you know, is complex
mm-hmm.
because kids like you that maybe didn't do well at school was maybe because you were bored or the structure
was.
Wasn't right. The structure wasn't right.
It was too rigid for me.
Right. The structure wasn't right.
Right.
And a lot of kids, you know, could get, you know, sort of garbaged or
right.
put aside just because they think and they learn differently.
Well, school for me was social.
Yes. But, you know, had you had maybe a different system, it
right.
would have been different. So.
I think had I had an American system, I probably would have suffered.
Right.
Right. Because I had a British system, which I have to say thank you to my teachers because
mm-hmm.
they saw the possibility.
Right.
But and I worked when I worked.
Right.
But I worked on the things that I liked. The
right.
things that I didn't like, I was just like,
right.
I just sort of skimmed through it. But like in school, I wasn't good at multiple choice.
Mm.
Why? Probably because I didn't study that hard.
Right.
I just kind of skimmed it and what I got is what I got. But it wasn't bad what I got.
Right.
But I really actually saw that if I had applied myself even just like 5% more,
right,
I could have done even better. But I don't care. It's fine. It's past. And school is, for me, especially school like that, is a form of domestication.
Interesting.
And it kills your freedom. It kills your self-expression. And I think that my interpretation of it, not saying it's the truth, but my interpretation of going to school, which hasn't really caught up with today's technology, was so that we could work in the factories, do what you're told, stand up, sit down, walk in a line, do all these things, that you could follow instructions, right? And that was built for like the Industrial Revolution, because they needed somebody who's going to sit there and go, press the button, press the button, all day long, whistle blow, get up, go home, you know, have a beer, screw your husband, screw your wife, come back to work again and press the button for the rest of your life for 30 odd years until you died.
Yeah.
Right? So people like you and I would have been, we're delinquents.
Right. Because we went rogue.
We go rogue, right?
We went rogue.
We can't follow the system. Yeah. We can't follow the structures.
Yeah, it's true.
And I think that it was what it was designed for. So now today, people have to think more. But like, we have to wake that mind up, I believe.
Right. Well, I think, I mean, the internet, even though I work a lot with, you know, managing the sort of potentially negative impacts that technology has, one positive application, one positive application of the internet is the democratization of information, right? So with the internet, you know, not everyone, because you still have to have money to have an internet connection and a computer, but you can certainly self-educate and niche educate in a manner that wasn't possible when we were kids. So I think that's been great.
Yeah, I think it's awesome. That's why I say it's important to find what you like, and you can excel with that. I mean, even, you know, people that, when we didn't have internet, there were people that did do, because they went
that
to the
anyway,
libraries.
Sure.
Yeah, so I mean, I can't even imagine sitting in a library pouring through books anymore.
I know, I miss it a little bit, to be honest. Once in a while, I go to the New York Public Library reading room. Yeah, just because there's something about the vibe in there that I kind of miss.
Energy left on the walls.
Yeah, I'm just a little nostalgic for that.
Right.
A little bit sometimes.
We're going to take a break and we'll be right back.
You're listening to the Talking Alternative Network.
Do you love or are you intrigued about New York City and its neighborhoods? I'm Jeff Goodman, host of Rediscovering New York, a weekly show that showcases New York's history and its extraordinary neighborhoods. Every Tuesday live at 7 p.m., we focus on a particular neighborhood and explore its history, its vibe, its feel, and its energy. Tune in live every Tuesday at 7 p.m. on talkradio.nyc.
The best designs for your life start at home. I'm David Thiergartner, interior designer and host of At Home. Listen live Tuesday nights at 8 p.m. Eastern Time as we talk to the very best professionals about interior design and the design that's all around us, right here on talkradio.nyc.
Talking Alternative Radio, 24 hours a day.
Beyond Potential, Live Life Your Way, and I'm with Melissa Unger, who is the founder of the Seymour Project. So I want to talk about the Seymour Project.
Okay.
So how did you start this?
Okay, so to go back a little bit, because we got sidetracked.
We always get sidetracked.
Yeah, it's okay. We were starting the career, so I'll just give it like in bullet points. So I started out in music videos, and it sort of leads into the Seymour Project, and people need to know. And so then I went from music videos to the film industry, and I worked in the film industry for about a decade on movie sets and working for actors as a personal assistant. And
which, anybody famous?
Yes. Do you have to make me say it? Yes.
Oh, I can say it.
I worked for Robert De Niro and for Daniel Day-Lewis.
The good people.
The good people. I was very young. I was in my early 20s and it was an extraordinary experience, as you can imagine. So I did that type of thing for a decade, which I loved. And again, ringside seat to some of the greatest creative minds mm-hmm. in the industry. I worked mm-hmm. with Martin Scorsese. I worked mm-hmm. with Robert Redford. I worked with Michelle Pfeiffer. I got very lucky. I hooked up with two assistant directors, Joe Reedy and Joe Burns, that were the best in the business. And I was on their team for a couple of years. And they really gave me my career, at that time. And then from there, the major point, there were other little things, but another pivot point was when I went to work for a company called Jumbo Pictures. That was a television company, and this leads into Seymour Projects. Mm-hmm. They were an animation company that did shows like Doug, and which was a children's show, and they also did 101 Dalmatians, the series. Right. And why this is important to my career is that while we were doing 101 Dalmatians, the series, we came into contact with something called, it was Harvard University's Project Zero. And Project mm-hmm. Zero was an educational group mm-hmm. that made sure that the animation that was geared toward children was pedagogic, and that like mm-hmm. so the little Dalmatians are solving their own problems as opposed to like adults coming in and solving their problems and whatever. And so that sort of piqued my interest in the idea of using creativity to mm-hmm. enact change in mm-hmm. people's minds or social change. Mm-hmm. So that sparked a desire to do that. And so that I don't tell my entire life story to your listeners.
No, it's fine. It's okay.
Okay, so I got really excited about that, and I applied to Columbia University to go get a master's in social work, mm-hmm. and I got into Columbia. Mm-hmm. But around that time, I met a friend who is now my friend, this woman, Paula Vail, who is the, I don't want to get her title wrong, but the executive vice president of communications at a company called the Ad Council.
Okay. And this I've heard of the Ad Council.
Yeah, this was in the 90s, and they are...
They had a big A, and it was black.
That's exactly right. Yes. They are a national organization that's existed since World War II. They're very famous in America. They do like Smokey Bear, Friends Don't Let Friends Drive Drunk, and mm-hmm. things like that.
Oh, cool.
And they're really where creativity and causes converge. Right. And I was vice president of media outreach there for about 5 years, and it changed the course of my life.
Right.
Because
so, what happened to the masters?
I didn't do it. I got the job instead. I decided to not go. I remember it being sort of very expensive and restrictive. I remember going to Columbia and being like, can I work at the same time? And she was like, I don't know. It's a heavy master's, like whatever. And so at the time, I just got this other job. I was like, let me try this and then I can always go back. And I never did. And to be honest, just slight regret. I would love to have a master's, mm-hmm. but didn't do both, and so did that. So that was really life-altering for me. We're getting to Seymour.
Right.
We'll put the Paris piece aside for now, but so I became really passionate about that type of thing.
Right.
And in my mid-40s, as I said, I'm 51 now, I founded Seymour Projects in 2011. Mm-hmm. I had gotten to a point in my career where I had felt that I had, frankly, that I had worked for others long enough.
Right.
And that I had a desire to sort of flip it around and go from the learning position mm-hmm. to sort of the giving position mm-hmm. and that I maybe had something to share. And so I took a couple of years to work some part-time jobs in the art world that I very much enjoyed, just sort of, to continue learning, but to have a little bit more free time, so I worked like 3 days a week. And I started weaving together quite brutally isn't the word, but I took like a real hard look at what I had to offer, mm-hmm. what my skills were, mm-hmm. and where I could make an impact. Mm-hmm. And I feel like it was a very, I don't know why I keep coming to the word brutal, because I feel like it wasn't a sugar-coated look at myself. It was sort of like...
Hardcore.
Yeah, it was like, unflattering. It was like, what am I really good at?
Right.
Like, what could I really
cutting
do?
Cutting out the bullshit.
Yeah, cutting out the bullshit and just being like, if we're going to do it, and what do I really want to do?
Right.
And so I weaved together a couple of different subjects, such as the humans, the mm-hmm. people, consciousness. Mm-hmm. At the time, technology was starting to be a real discussion point mm-hmm. in the world. Now we're so used to it. But when I founded Seymour Projects, very few people were talking about the impact that smartphones and tether tech were having on our consciousness and on our relationships. So I like to think I was definitely in the first wave of people that started talking about that. And so I'll just pause for a second, but that's how it sort of started doing that. Mm-hmm. And, because I don't have children, it was a way also for me to feel like I was giving back and nurturing in some way.
Cool. So how do you come up with the word Seymour?
So Seymour is my father's first name, which people think is maybe a little bit weird, but it's, I think it has something to do with not having kids. And my dad passed away about 20 years ago, and we had a great relationship. And I felt like he gave me a lot of opportunities in my life. He also had multiple sclerosis, and I grew up with him in a wheelchair my whole life. And I feel like the sort of combination of his sense of humor and also growing up with someone with an illness gave me a particular perspective on the world that was sort of helpful to growing compassion and empathy that I have for other people, you know.
Yeah.
So I think that I owe him that in a way. And then Seymour is also, we're very lucky. It's like, we help you see more is
That's
our
right.
tagline.
Exactly.
So we got lucky. And actually his nickname was Cy. So people didn't call him Seymour that often. So it's kind of, it's his name and yet it's my own thing at the same time. So it works out nicely.
So you did Seymour in Paris?
Yes. So my mother is French and the piece that we left out in the life story that we'll put back in now is, while I was at the Ad Council, around the fifth year of the Ad Council, it was Sex and the City time in New York and things were crazy and I was about
Cosmos.
Yeah, it was Cosmos and girlfriends and boys and I was about 35 and it was just reaching a point of saturation for me. I sort of felt, not the Ad Council specifically, but the sort of dynamic that was happening around me in New York was starting to feel just time to go.
Right.
You know, it had been over a decade since I'd graduated university. And I will say that I've probably always had that sort of navigation system in me. I remember interviewing Judy Nylon, who's a punk goddess, who's in her 70s now, or 60s. She's going to kill me. She's probably in her late 60s. And she's going to be like, thanks, Mel. You just aged me a whole bunch. But she and I
bond. I call it rock and roll.
She looks fantastic. She looks like 20 years younger, but she's she's not that. She's probably, sorry, Jude. I know, Jude. You're probably like 65 or something. I don't know how
I'm
old
friends
she is.
With Maxi Priest.
Yeah.
And I was saying to him, you're about da, 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 da. And he goes, oh, don't say it. I said, all right, then. You're rock and roll 35.
Yeah, she's rock and roll 35.
Like dog years, you know?
But she and I bonded on this, and there's a word, and I don't know what it is. It's a German word, but it's this sort of nose, you know, like a sense for knowing what's coming next and when it's time to move.
Right.
And I don't know that I realized that I had that. It was, you know, hindsight is always 20/20. But when I, at 51, when I look back at my life, I realize that I have that for my own life and professionally also, which means that there's just some weird instinct when I know it's time to go.
Right.
And for other people, when I consult, I sort of can orient, you know, it's like with innovation or sort of what's next. So I just had this feeling that it was time to go. And then there were a host of things happening in my personal life that I won't share, not out of, you know, whatever the word is, out of Trudeau. This is where I don't speak English, but like, but just because it's not that interesting to the listener. But there was a confluence of events that made me go to France. And that was another big pivot in my life. And I think that even though...
So did you know what you were going to do?
No, no. So I was at the Ad Council and I had, because I was VP, I had had a nice salary for a couple of years. And so I had a little bit of money saved and I made the leap and I was supposed to go for 3 months and I stayed 14 years, which is the joke, right? No, I did not know what I was going to do. It was really sort of, to be honest, just a break.
Right.
But because I had always worked and I engaged with the world through projects and through people after, like, you know, the first 3 weeks of, you know, doing nothing, I was bored. I didn't know anybody. So I was like, I need to get a job.
Right.
And I didn't want like a serious, you know, like an Ad Council type of job at the time. So I took what I thought was not a difficult job, which was working at an art gallery through a friend. And my life has always sort of just happened to me. And this is where a little bit of luck does come into it, as I ended up working for one of the most respected and well-known art galleries in Paris, which was this gallery, Thaddeus Ropac. And I always thank Thaddeus Ropac for opening that door to me because I really had no experience in an art gallery. But I guess I had experience with organization and systems and stuff. So he let me in. And I worked there for a couple of years, and that really sort of set up a possibility for me to stay in France. It set up a social system and, you know, a calling card. And then sort of between then and Seymour, I did consulting. I worked for ArtNet. You know, I did all sorts of stuff. But I think that by the time I got to Paris, the real Melissa was starting to to emerge. And so for your show, in terms of Live Life Your Way, I would say that that previous chapter that we just discussed, let's call it my unconscious life. Right. Like, I feel like I was allowing the locus of control to be outside myself, and I was sort of responding to situations. And when I got on that plane and went to France, I think it was the first time in my life that I took control of my destiny in a way. And I think that the whole time that I spent in France was really me turning the boat around, so to speak, of, you know, going from having life done to me doing to life in a way. And it was very uncomfortable. I wish I could tell people, and it was amazing, and it was so easy, and it was lovely, and the wind was at my back, and that wasn't the case. When you're changing, you know, your way of being, there were tremendous opportunities, and it was an incredible time, but it was really effing hard, like, every step of the way, because I was doing things completely differently, you know, and so it was really challenging, you know, and there's that quote, and
but
I
you met the challenge.
I did meet the challenge.
And
but
what could it look like for somebody who's looking to say, you know what, I want to get up and go. I want to just go. What would you say to them, and how would you tell them to meet the challenge?
Well, I would, one of the biggest things I think that I've done in my life that most people don't do that has helped me be successful is that I'm willing to take two steps back to take three steps forward, which means that I finished the Ad Council. I was VP of Media Outreach. I made upwards of $100,000 a year, and I took a plane, and the first gig at Ropac before they hired me, I worked for 500 euros, which is nothing. It's like 500, 400 bucks, you know, for an afternoon, you know, putting name tags on the table placements, you know, at a dinner party they were having, you know, just to get my foot in the door. And then once I was there, they were like, wait a minute, like, who are you? Like, you're clearly, you know, I started behaving in the way that, like, I had years of experience. But I think that a lot of people get really caught up in what it looks like to others and saving face. And I think it shuts them out of opportunities because they're worried about what people think. And probably for that same weird, like, you know, autistic thing that makes me not be able to take tests or whatever, I just, I don't care. Like, it's really weird. It's like, I, you know, I get neurotic about certain things, like inadvertently hurting someone or not living up to someone. Like, when we sit on the show, I have neurotic concerns about not disappointing you. Do you know what I mean?
Yes, I know.
But I
you can never disappoint
But
me.
I have no, conversely, I have no issues around sort of what people think about what I'm doing with my life. You know what I mean? Like, I just, so I think that to answer your question specifically,
and
is don't be afraid.
Now you live into that consciously.
Yeah, don't be afraid to take a step back. Don't be afraid to burn it down. You know, when I left France to come here, I was at the top of my professional game. Like, I built a project that was incredibly successful. I was in all the magazines. I was, you know, beyond my wildest dreams of what I could ever have accomplished. It's different for everyone, right? Everyone's definition of success.
But it's parlayed to that what you just said. I mastered it. I got it. And then it's time
to
move on.
So for me, it was sufficient, you know, and for some other people, like, you know,
they want to ride it.
Right.
To
like
the
my
end.
Friend Nikolai calls it 15 square meters of fame. It's like people know me in a tiny little area, but that was enough for me. I accomplished what I don't need, you know, more than that. And I, you know, I when I closed the space, a lot of people were like, what the hell? Like, you're what, you know? And I was like, yeah, I think we got it, right? Like, everybody got it, you know? And it was very confusing for people, and people wanted to scale it, and, you know, and I think the second answer to your question is really be true to yourself.
Absolutely.
You know, because everyone's definition of success is different. For some people, success means security.
And there's no such animal.
But some people feel that. So they will accumulate wealth, or they will accumulate a brand, or they will, you know, for some people it's comfort. For some people it's different for everyone. And so when people give you advice, they often give you the wrong advice for you, because they give you advice based on what their definition of success is. So
that's why being a coach, I said to people, I can't give you advice. Because I'm not living your life. If I give you advice, I'm going to give you my life. And I used to describe myself as, I'm the big black girl in Brooklyn. You don't want the big black girl in Brooklyn's life. You want your own life.
And when I started to be successful with that, and everyone was like, scale and make money and do this stuff, I was like, I was fortunate to grow up in a comfortable socioeconomic situation. So I didn't struggle when I was a child. I was very privileged. And then I worked for...
I'm glad you said that.
Like, I did.
You're really comfortable with that. Because a lot of people are not... A lot of white people are not comfortable with saying they were very privileged.
But it's the truth.
Yeah.
I would be totally disingenuous to say anything different.
Absolutely.
Like, I feel like, you know, I was very lucky. I was very fortunate. Mm-hmm. But it also showed, because my father's illness and other, you know, you can be privileged financially and handicapped in other ways.
Yes.
I don't want to take the conversation dark.
Right.
But I certainly have... You know, I would say more than my fair share of emotional baggage, mm-hmm. even though I had more than my fair share of financial comforts, let's say. So maybe it levels out. I don't know. But the point that I'm making is more when people give you advice, because I had access to that and I knew that it didn't actually make people happy necessarily to have money, that it wasn't the be all end all.
Right.
And then I worked for all these celebrities.
We need to take a break.
Yep. Oh, I'll close it.
We need to take a break.
Okay.
We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Talking Alternative Network.
I'm the aptly named host of Tony Martinetti Nonprofit Radio. Big nonprofit ideas for the other 95%. Fundraising, board relations, social media. My guests and I cover everything that small and mid-sized shops struggle with. If you have big dreams and a small budget, you have a home at Tony Martinetti Nonprofit Radio. Fridays, 1 to 2 Eastern at talkingalternative.com.
Are you a conscious co-creator? Are you on a quest to raise your vibration and your consciousness? I'm Sam Liebowitz, your conscious consultant, and on my show, The Conscious Consultant Hour, Awakening Humanity, we will touch upon all these topics and more. Listen live at our new time on Thursdays at 12 noon Eastern Time. That's The Conscious Consultant Hour, Awakening Humanity, Thursdays, 12 noon on talkradio.nyc.
TalkingAlternative.com.
On Beyond Potential, Live Life Your Way. And we're having a fantastic conversation with Melissa Unger of the CIMO Project. So we're going to get back into that conversation, get back in the zone.
So where I was that I was going to say about people's definitions of success being different and advice mm-hmm. giving, just to close that loop, was that also working for celebrities, I got into sort of that room that everybody wants to get into mm-hmm. very early. You mm-hmm. know, let's call it the VIP room or the magic room or the behind the velvet rope, you know? And I think it was a gift of my life to sort of know early on that money doesn't totally make happiness, that celebrity doesn't, you know, save
it's
you
responsibility.
From anything. And so I think that... my life became about something else. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So often it creates like a torque in conversations with me, with people, particularly with quote unquote business building.
Right.
And one of my ways of hacking it was to be in nonprofits because I just got tired of telling people that I didn't want to scale. Do you know what I mean?
Right.
Like everybody was always like, more, bigger, more, you know? Right. And I was like, that's not interesting to me because I know the end game of that. I know what that looks like.
Right.
And that gives me less freedom, not more. Do you know what I mean? So I had to play with different models that helped me, you know, sort of understand what works for me. And I think that, you know, certainly with the work that you do and the sort of crux of this show is really know thyself, right?
Absolutely.
And so once it took me 40 years. Some people find their passions very early. I think that I knew subconsciously and I was programmed to be this person.
Right.
And I just took a very long time to break off, you know, all mm-hmm. of those things that we talked
Chip
about,
away
those shackles.
The parts
right,
that
exactly.
You, right.
But if you know yourself, then once I understood that, that the wind that was at my face became at my back, because now decision making is really easy. Do you know what I mean? It's sort of like, you know, I put, you know, my values at the center, and so it's just easy.
Do I like this? Does this interest me? Is this fun? Easy. Is this going
to
be? You know,
it's easy
like
to make decisions, you know. And I had,
and it's not based upon money.
No,
all the time.
No, but here's an interesting thing. I think I swung so far in the other direction that in recent years I've been swinging back a little bit, just in terms of allowing money to just be seen as an energy.
Absolutely.
And knowing that if I have to find a way to leverage it that feels clean to me so that I can have a broader reach if I want it. And I think that we have a tendency when we're correcting something to overcorrect for a little while.
Right.
And then you sort of come back to a neutral. Yes, right. So, and I think that for me, and also another thing that's important for listeners, I think finding their path is that in America, particularly, we have a tendency to just want like a quick answer.
Right.
And I would say that now that I'm, I know I keep beating the drum that I'm in my 50s, but I'm really excited about
it. I think it's really good that you do that.
I'm really excited about it because I feel like I'm a couple of decades in, you know, and I feel like what you need and who you are and what your priorities and desires are changes from decade to decade. And I think that it's really important to take stock at each decade and sort of clean your emotional closet out, you know? And when I moved back to the States, it was to coincide exactly with my 50th birthday.
Right.
And I literally sat down and I did like a list, you know, like a vision list for what my 50s would look like.
Right,
and it's totally different than what my 40s would look like and totally different than what my 30s would look like. So I don't think that as human beings, we do the headlines of, you know, these are my values and this is it forever. Or this is what I want.
Static.
It's like, no, it's totally in flux, you know? And certainly for me, I had the bucket of work and professionalism and striving was filled to overflowing.
Right.
And the sort of, even though my personal life is filled with friends and it's lovely, I do feel like I wanted to, like, you know, Sheryl Sandberg says lean in. I actually wanted to lean back.
Right.
I felt like I had been an eager beaver and a striver and an A student for a really long time.
Right.
And I wanted to sort of moon energy rather than sun energy a little bit. Do you know what I mean?
Gotcha.
And see what happens when I lean back and let things come to me.
Right.
As opposed to...
Because you're generating.
Yeah, as opposed to just like striving. So.
Right. But that's great. And you know what I love? I love... So here's the thing. You're in America now. So in America, people don't talk about... Women don't talk about the ages.
Oh, that's interesting. I'm so
and,
proud.
And in my experience, white women don't talk about their ages.
That's so funny.
No, it's kind of like... You know, black women too, but...
Right.
My experience is a lot of white women don't will not say, how old are you? I'm not saying it. I don't want to talk about it. And that conversation was very early for me when I first came here, when my friends were like, oh, I'm going to be 30. You're going to be 30? What are you talking about? You know, they're like, I'm going to be 30. I'm so old. And I'm just like, what are you talking about?
I feel super young. I'm actually very open. And it's funny because I...
Were you always this open about it?
Yes. Yes. I think that I don't have children and I've been in long-term relationships, but I'm single right now. So you would think that I would be hiding my age.
Right.
But I don't at all. And I'm very proud of it. And I always have been.
Right.
I think I feel very young at heart. I've always been slightly emotionally immature, which I actually think is an asset because it keeps me just really curious and kind of dumb, you know, like I take dumb risks, you know, that I might not take if I were more emotionally mature, but they've served me.
Would you say they're dumb risks, or would you say they're things that you that attract you and you go after
them? I think
they
attract me, but I think that youthfulness is
it's
not
great.
A dumb risk, but it's served me. So
absolutely.
I feel so young inside that my outer age doesn't mean anything.
That's how I feel.
Right.
I feel like so young, like I would say my eternal age is 60.
Right. 16?
16.
Oh, that's funny.
Right?
I'm not that young. Like in my head, I'm in
because
my 30s.
Because at 16 is when I became my person.
That's it. Oh, see, that's really interesting.
Right.
Because I feel like that's fascinating because I feel like I'm in my 30s.
Right.
And that's when I became me, when I went to France.
Right.
That's really interesting, Noreen. I never thought that.
Yeah, because I felt like at 16, that was when I left school. I had sex.
Mm-hmm.
I told my mother I was working because I went to work as well.
Mm-hmm.
16, 17, right? And so all those milestones that we have in life, like work and sex and all those things. Those were when I was like more in tuned with myself, and I told my mother, you can't tell me what to do anymore. You can ask me,
right,
but you can no longer tell me. And she agreed. And that was when I stepped into being a woman. I mean, yes, I was a girl and I was married by 20 and I called myself baby bride.
Oh, wow.
But I feel like that was when
that's really interesting, because I'm like really self-aware, and that is something that I had never thought of. So right. Good on you, because I was a very late bloomer,
right?
For lots of reasons, and I think that I feel not stuck at 34, but because right. what you just described right. is what I experienced at 34. Right. That's really interesting. But yeah, and that's you were asking me earlier off Mike, the difference between France and the United States, and certainly on this topic. Older women are much more accepted in right. France, and we stay sexy longer, mm-hmm. and we stay, and we don't have to hide our age, and mm-hmm. there's no, you know, Botox or right. anything, you know, so awesome. I'm super comfortable.
So we've come to the end of the bloody show.
Oh my God.
Mate.
We
yeah.
Barely,
like seriously,
like we've
scratched
the surface,
right? Yeah. Everybody says that because yeah. that's how the show goes, yeah. right? But it's been such a pleasure. Yeah. Thank you so much. You should come again.
I loved being here.
You should come again. Thank you so much for being here. It was awesome.
I loved it.
I love you.
Yeah, I love you,
and,
too.
And, yeah. So this is Noreen Sumter signing off on Beyond Potential. Live life your way. I'll see you next week when I have Storm and Norman, a DJ, on the show. See you guys later. Bye.
You're listening to the Talking Alternative Network.
You're listening to the Talking Alternative Network. Are you stuck in a rut? Negative thoughts, feelings, and conversations got you down? Hi, I'm Noreen Sumter, the Potentiator. Tune in every Tuesday at 9 to 10 p.m. Eastern Time and listen for new ideas on my show, Beyond Potential, Live Life Your Way, on talkradio.nyc.
I'm the aptly named host of Tony Martinetti Nonprofit Radio. Big nonprofit ideas for the other 95%. Fundraising, board relations, social media. My guests and I cover everything that small and mid-sized shops struggle with. If you have big dreams and a small budget, you have a home at Tony Martinetti Nonprofit Radio. Fridays, 1 to 2 Eastern at talkingalternative.com.
Hey, all you crazy listeners. Looking to boost your business? Why not advertise on Talking Alternative with very reasonable rates? Interested? Simply email at info@talkingalternative.com.
The best designs for your life start at home. I'm David Thiergartner, interior designer and host of At Home. Listen live Tuesday nights at 8 p.m. Eastern Time as we talk to the very best professionals about interior design and the design that's all around us, right here on talkradio.nyc.
You're listening to the Talking Alternative Network at www.talkingalternative.com. Now, broadcasting 24 hours a day. Talking Alternative.
Do you love or are you intrigued about New York City and its neighborhoods? I'm Jeff Goodman, host of Rediscovering New York, a weekly show that showcases New York's history and its extraordinary neighborhoods. Every Tuesday live at 7 p.m., we focus on a particular neighborhood and explore its history, its vibe, its feel, and its energy. Tune in live every Tuesday at 7 p.m. on talkradio.nyc.
You're listening to the Talking Alternative Network.